Hi, my name's Mirza Asif. I'm one of the telescope array controllers that works here at George Will Bank.
We're standing in this room which looks a little bit like a kind of mini James Bond set with a huge window in front of me and an even huger telescope outside, which is obviously the Lovell telescope. Can you tell me a little bit about what I can see around in the control room?
Well, I mean, a lot of people say that it looks very similar to, as you say, something from Star Trek, where you have the control desk and it's, controlling the telescope.
It's quite retro.
Yes, it's very retro. Original control desk built in the 1950s with modern electronics inside. Basically, what we have on the control desk are instruments that tell us the wind speeds, faults that occur with the telescope, the status, displays, position of the telescope.
You mentioned wind speed earlier on as being quite crucial. I can imagine this thing could quite easily pick up the wind if it was quite blowy. What are the difficulties there?
Yes, the wind speed is very important. So basically, if it's gusting to 45 miles per hour or above, we have to park the telescope at the zenith, which means pointing straight up. We actually align the towers of the telescope into the wind as well. So the whole structure is pretty much 90 degrees to the wind. The wind is going across the structure.
If you get it wrong, it essentially acts as a huge sail and potentially gets ripped out of the ground, is that?
Yes, actually that's true. There was an incident back in the early 70s where something similar happened. There was a giant gust of over 90 miles per hour, which actually lifted the whole telescope up off the rails. And what they did to counteract that was they turned the telescope in such a way as that the gust actually pushed it back onto the rail in the opposite direction. So that's how they solved that one, which was very ingenious.
There's been a few people who've got out with the lift at the top and looked at the drop and thought, I'm not going any farther than this. When you actually have to step out and make that step onto the walkway with that drop below you, it can be a bit frightening.
I'm Tim O'Brien, I'm one of the astronomers here at George Will Bank. We're standing on the walkway that leads from one of the towers that holds up the big dish of the Lovell telescope across to the walkway. It takes us from the top of the tower across to the middle of the dish. So above us, just sort of 50, 60 feet above us here, is the actual ball of the telescope. And in fact, what you can see, the surface you can see there is the original surface that was put on this telescope when it was completed in 1957. In 1970, a new surface was actually built on top of the old surface, so the old surface was kept and there's a gap between the two. And in fact, we'll head up there in a minute through that gap before we head out onto the current surface. That new surface was put on basically just to give a better... The shape of the surface matters as to how good the telescope is, and it's a much better shaped surface. It's a much closer to the parabola that surface has to be. So that was done in 1970, and then that surface again was replaced back in 2002. So now we have a surface 76 metres in diameter. It's the third largest steerable telescope in the world, which has the correct shape to within a few millimetres across that whole 76 metre surface.
Okay, so we're now in this space in between the original surface and the new surface.
Yeah. So it's an amazing space, quite echoey, between these two great metal balls. And in the surface below us now, the original 1950s surface, you can see the light sort of coming through these holes where the support struts are holding up the upper surface, and the occasional rust hole as well, of course, with it being such an old and unused surface now.
And a bit of local wildlife as well in the background. before we move on, I just wanted to ask about, this whole telescope, as you know, as we've seen, has been sort of evolving over the years, and it's about to undergo a new evolution, if you like, as part of the eMerlin project. Can you just say a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this telescope is the third largest in the world. What that means is it has great sensitivity. It collects a lot of radio waves. It's so big. But what it can't do is it can't, on its own, give us a very clear view of the sky, a very sharp view of the sky. What we do to achieve that is we connect it together with several other radio telescopes, in fact six other radio telescopes, one here at Jodrell and five others spread across the country, to make the Merlin network. What that gives us, it gives us a much sharper view. It's like looking out the window of a jet aircraft on your holidays and being able to read somebody's newspaper down on the ground. That's the sort of sharpness of view that we get with our telescope. What we're about to do in E-Merlin is we're about to get work in a system where we've connected our telescopes together with fibre optics. So it's going to be a broadband telescope. We're going to have, it's like going from a dial-up connection to a broadband connection at home. We'll get far more information through from the objects in space that we look at. And in fact, it'll increase the power of the telescope so much that we'll be able to do in one day what would have previously taken us 3 years to do.
And that's purely because of the kind of bandwidth of information that you're getting in now?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not at the moment the radio signals are brought back from the remote telescopes and combined here using what are called radio links, just basically point-to-point radio links. We're going to replace that with fibre optics for the same reason that you use fibre optics for an internet connection, let's say. It's like using a big fatter pipe, you get higher bandwidth, more data down it per second. When that system's operating, when E-Merlin's running, we'll actually be collecting about three times as much data here at Jodrell than the total UK internet traffic. So whatever anybody's doing on the web, on the internet during the day, we're collecting three times as much information per second here at Jodrell when that's running. It's a phenomenal instrument.
So Tim, we're now standing on the dish itself, yeah. In the bowl. Thankfully, it's facing directly upwards. So tell us a bit about the sort of astronomical phenomena you can look at with this.
Yeah, I mean, if we're looking up today, it's a lovely sunny day, actually. Mostly clear blue sky above us. If our eyes worked at radio wavelengths, if we had little radio dishes instead of eyes and we were looking up now, the sky wouldn't be so bright. It wouldn't be this sort of bright blue. We'd basically be looking straight out into space even during the day, and sort of arching above us would be the Milky Way, so our galaxy, the galaxy that the Sun is part of. So there's something like 100,000 million stars in the Milky Way. If you see the Milky Way with your eyes, if you've ever done that, then what you're seeing are the hot surfaces of stars. In the radio, with our radio sensitive eyes, with this radio telescope, when we look up, we don't see stars very easily. They're very faint. What we see is the stuff between the stars. It's the electrons in between the stars spiralling around the galactic magnetic field. And then sort of scattered around on that arching Milky Way is the points of radio light. And those are not stars, although when they were first discovered back in the 1940s and 50s, that's what they were thought to be. They're actually either stars that have died at the end of their lives, exploded stars, or in fact, more commonly, things we call quasars, distant radio galaxies, way off at the edge of the observable universe, where at the hearts of those galaxies, there's supermassive black holes, and as stuff falls in towards that black hole, it generates a lot of energy, including a lot of radio waves, which we then see as these sort of point-like objects. So with a radio telescope like this, we see a completely different view of the universe than we would with an optical telescope. And of course, that's why we do radio astronomy.
And what would you say are the most significant discoveries that this telescope has contributed to?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. When it was first built, it was not designed to do the things, in fact, we use it for today. The objects that we look at with this telescope now were not even known when the telescope was built over 50 years ago. It's probably three major areas of science that it's been involved in would be quasars, so the distant galaxies with the supermassive black holes. This telescope played a crucial role in the discovery and the understanding of what they were. Also gravitational lenses. These were phenomena predicted by Einstein as part of his theory of gravity, general relativity. It's where light is bent around massive objects, and this telescope picked up the first gravitational lens. Pulsars, which are stars that have exploded. It's the remnant of an exploded star. The central part of the star collapses in on itself to make something about the size of a city that spins around maybe once a second. And as it spins, it sort of beams these sort of almost lighthouse-like beams of radiation across the galaxy. And as it spins, we see the flash, 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 hence the name pulsar. And we pick up those signals with this telescope and time their arrival to study extreme physics.
And Sir Bernard Lovell, who's was the man who's this was his brainchild and who built it. In the 50s, he he was well in a lot of hot water really, because he was spending an awful lot of money. The project had gone massively over budget, and you know, there was even a possibility that he might go to prison because of his sort of supposedly profligate use of public funds. But it's all a bit unfair really, because he was not really allowed to defend himself. What was going on?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few reasons why it did go vastly over budget, and he certainly was in trouble for that and was in danger of being thrown into jail. And there were several reasons for it. I mean, some of them were scientific, changes in the design of the telescope. Of course, nobody had ever done anything like this before, so, you know, he couldn't have very easily predicted how much it would cost to build such a thing. But one of the interesting reasons is that it's come out recently that, in fact, he was secretly asked to redesign the telescope such that it would be capable of detecting missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles directed at this country, and by basically sending out a radar signal from this telescope and looking for an echo, we'd be able to provide, you know, the classic 4-minute warning of nuclear attack. So yeah, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, this was the UK's early warning defence system, and that's only recently come out.
I'm Dr. Tom Muxlower, staff astronomer here at eMerlin. My particular research project is one involving very distant star-forming galaxies, and we have indeed been looking at many of these objects with the existing Merlin array, and we're able to detect and actually take images of these distant star-forming galaxies. But at present, with our limitations on sensitivity, we can only see the most extreme objects at the greatest distances furthest back in time. And eMerlin, with a huge step forward in sensitivity, will allow us to see pretty much the run-of-the-mill type events at these sort of distances.
So, and we were talking back in time because, of course, it takes, you know, the further something is away, the longer it's taken for the electromagnetic radiation to reach us. I mean, the sorts of things that you can see at the moment, are they, you know, gamma ray bursts, sort of massive supernovae, things like that, massive events that gave off a lot of energy?
Well, these are violent events. These objects are star-forming galaxies. They are the remnant dwarf galaxies that were left over after the early phase of the universe, and they are combining together to build up the large spiral galaxies that we see around us today. So this is a period of galaxy formation and star formation in that. So we're able to see these galaxies building their populations of stars. And the further out in space you look, of course, as you say, the further back in time we go. So we want to actually trace the star formation history of the normal, ordinary type galaxies that we see around us today, like our own galaxy, the Milky Way.